Hello, and welcome to the Migration Oxford podcast. I'm Jackie Broadhead.
And I'm Rob McNeil.
Today we're talking about diaspora engagement, but what do we mean when we say the word diaspora?
Well, I mean, I think this is a really complicated question in some respects, because it's a word that's changed in meaning, I think, over the last 50 or 60 years, from the original idea that it was something that related to communities like the Jewish and the Armenian communities that had been effectively exiled for many generations and had held together a community, that diaspora community, through, you know, traditions and membership of that social group over a long period of time, through to something which really now describes just communities, any communities that are living overseas or in different countries, or that are held together by those sort of bonds of community when they come from one place and are living in another. And importantly, those groups have political power now. Those are groups that exercise political power both in their countries of destination and in the countries of origin often. And there are efforts commonly to engage those communities. And that's what a lot of our conversation today has been about. But that this is something that's common and it's understood socially as part of the fabric of modern society.
And that's, I think, one of the most interesting shifts that we're looking at here. This move from perhaps seeing diasporas as something vulnerable or quite fragmented, struggling to maybe maintain those connections with each other and also with their country of origin and the ways in which they do that, through to actually being agents of quite a lot of power, whether that's kind of hard and soft political power, whether that's the idea of diasporas as agents within diplomacy, but also economically through things like remittances. What do we know about that shift in the way that we're perceiving the power of diaspora?
Well, I think that it's clear, and it was very clear in the conversation that we both had on, you know, that was recorded and in the conversation that we had afterwards, that there have been massive shifts in the way that we perceive these communities even. But also, I mean, just things like the sort of digital revolution that we've had, the ease of communicating with people now, the ease of just speaking to family members that may be thousands of miles away, and being involved in the day-to-day politics of your country of origin and also of your country of residence, has made a fundamental change to the way that diaspora communities are engaged with modern society, and has really highlighted that they can have profound power in, you know, both political power at home and political power in those countries of origin as well. I mean, that shift is evident, as you say, in everything from the enormous importance of remittances as a means of bringing about international development. It dwarfs the money generated for developing economies from remittances absolutely dwarfs international aid budgets. All the way through to, you know, fundamental political shifts, changes in the way that people perceive how their countries should function. And this is enormous. It's a massive, massive thing and something that we really can't ignore.
Absolutely. And are there risks, do you think, to having this kind of approach? I mean, you know, one example of a person who we could describe as being from a diaspora community would be our own Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and his background. But at a certain point, as you become, you know, these terms like second or third generation, they can also become a little bit problematic because they, in some ways, call into question your membership of being British, of the community that you now live in. How do you think we manage that will to want to engage with diaspora communities, understand our global connectedness, but also not inadvertently even discriminate or describe people as being in some ways not fully part of the communities that they now belong to?
A really key part of this is the recognition that we all have multiple identities. You know, we're all, I grew up in Wiltshire. I see myself very much as a sort of Wiltshire boy, but I'm British as well. I can also be European, and I'm also, like, I have Scottish and Irish heritage, and all of these are things that comprise me as an individual, you know? And I think that all of us have components of that. And the fact that, you know, being British doesn't stop me from being from Malmesbury. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't stop me from having Irish heritage. It doesn't stop any of those kinds of things from being a part of who I am at the same time. And I think it's perfectly reasonable and perfectly possible for people to have these multiple identities. And all of those things can coexist without actually having any conflict. There's no reason why it's not possible to be a multitude of different things at the same time. Now, obviously, that can sometimes mean that, you know, you prioritize one component of your identity over another every now and then. But that doesn't mean that your other that the other components of your identity are irrelevant in those situations. And I think that depending on how we operate, depending on who we are and what we're doing, we can quite comfortably be these different things at different times. It's perfectly possible for Rishi Sunak to be a very British, very conservative prime minister representing very conservative ideals and things that are fundamentally related to, you know, like what it means to be a British citizen, whilst at the same time not running away from his own heritage and not ignoring who he is, because you can be something which is multiple, which is different. I think organisations like British Future and the work that Sundar Katwala has done at British Future have really helped to identify that to be British in the modern world doesn't mean being white, and it doesn't mean, you know, singing Jerusalem in church on a Sunday or anything like that. It can be something which is about your origins that are much more complex than that. And there's no reason why that Britishness is necessarily any more or less than anybody else's Britishness. So I think that it's really important to remember that, you know, yeah, being part of a diaspora is an important part of who you are, but it doesn't mean that it defines everything that you do always.
That feels like the perfect point for us to, without further ado, get to our conversation with our experts.
I'm here with Alan Gamlin, who's Professor of Migration Governance at the Australian National University, with Martin Russell, who's the Director of Global Diaspora Insights, and with Larissa Lara, who is Diaspora Engagement Officer for the International Organisation for Migration. So, Alan, I want to start with the basics. What are diaspora engagement policies and what are they designed to achieve?
Thanks, Rob. And thanks for the invite to be with you here tonight, or whatever it is where you are. So, yeah, diaspora engagement policies are essentially government policies and programs directed towards or dedicated to immigrants and their descendants who are living abroad. So I say the word immigrants carefully so that you don't get my Kiwi accent mixed up. So people who leave. So we typically think of migration policy as policy towards people who arrive, but actually for probably the majority of countries around the world, it's actually towards people who leave. It's people leaving that they're most interested in. And so there's a whole range of things that countries, governments and countries of origins want from or with people who leave. Often diaspora engagement policies are, you know, about negotiating bilateral agreements over supply of labour or preparing migrants to undertake their journeys or protecting the rights and interests of those migrants when they're abroad, trying to address their concerns, facilitating their remittances back to the country of origin, preserving their identities and ties through cultural exchange programs, cultivating networks of influential and affluent compatriots who are living in other countries and might be able to help their country of origin. So there's a whole range of things.
Fantastic. So Larissa, can I just ask you, why do you think now is a key time to talk about diaspora communities driving change?
Thank you. In the past years, there has been a lot of attention given to diasporas, and this is really great. And in particular, it has been pushed by member states and a lot of great partners. So last year in April, we co-organized with the Government of Ireland the Global Diaspora Summit, and we had a really great opportunity to bring together diasporas in the same on the same table with the governments. So they were really exchanging and putting out there what their needs are and also what they can bring to the table in development and in humanitarianism. So I would say it's a very key and exciting moment to engage with diasporas and recognize them as development and humanitarian actors, specifically because we have together after the Dublin Declaration, we have a very concrete plan, which is the outcome document from it. It's called the Dublin Declaration, and it really sets a step-by-step goals of what the global community will be doing in the next year to maximize diaspora engagement. And through it, particularly, I just want to highlight the Global Diaspora Policy Alliance, which is really that environment to institutionalize the relationship between governments, diasporas, partners in the private sector, and other partners across the world that want to engage with diasporas and partner with them to maximize development in their countries of origin and destination.
Okay, so Martin, the term diaspora itself seems to have evolved quite a lot in the last few decades. So we've been talking so far about the role of diaspora in bringing about things like change in development context in countries of origin and that sort of thing. But what do we actually mean when we talk about diaspora now?
Alan kind of gave us the early kind of answers to that on one level when we begin to think about immigrants and their descendants. And, you know, I think, as you mentioned, over the last, I think, kind of 10 to 15 years, there's been a real acceleration of interest, not just from countries of origin, but also countries of destination, and not just government as well. I think private sector are getting more and more interest in this area. I think foundations in the third sector are beginning to pick up on it. And the word I would use is that I think diaspora has gone mainstream over the last 10 to 15 years. And I mean, 15, 20 years ago, if you said to somebody, I'm working on diaspora, they'd say to you, have you found a cure yet? No, nobody really kind of knew what it meant on one level, to be frank, you know, and I think people kind of understood that it's related to migration. But I think the level of kind of critical thinking and analysis, and particularly academically, of the evolution of diaspora studies, kind of with the breakdown of the Cold War, began to really kind of refocus the mind on the topic. So I think we talk about immigrants and descendants, but the word that captures it for me, I think, is belonging. When we talk about diasporas, the word I would say it's about having a sense of belonging. And that belonging is not just to a government anymore, as I say. Organizations of different ilk are beginning to look at this topic. Universities have diasporas, but they call them alumni. But, you know, we begin to kind of take lessons and insights from there. So that's what I would say. And just to kind of close out what we talk about, at least for me and my understanding of diaspora, I think it's important that we do try to unpack those relationships between migration and diaspora. So I often say that migration is the language of borders and identity, but diaspora is the language of belonging and identification. I think it's a bit more of a fluid concept. So that's how I would kind of bring those two together, in essence.
Okay, excellent. So Larissa, how should we think about the role of diaspora engagement compared to community leadership and empowerment? And where do you think that diaspora engagement is going to shape communities or even the world in the coming years? And can you give us some ideas about where we can see this happening already?
Thank you. I think Martin put the perfect word to it, is belonging, and how to really understand belonging and how we can make that into positive change. I think that's the key area of studies in diaspora. Just to add on that, I really think diasporas are unique. They are actors that really understand at least two or three settings. And even when you're doing your bureaucracy, it's really interesting to see how diasporas can manage to navigate those spaces in a very easy way. So they really serve as bridges in society. They reduce the gaps and distances, they maximize strategic connections, they foster partnerships and resource mobilization. So I think in the future, we will continue to see diasporas engaging, especially at the humanitarian level, I would say. Unfortunately, we will keep looking at conflicts and all the issues that are driven by climate emergency. And I'm a truly believer that diasporas will be at the forefront because they have done so for many years. So I think those are the engagements that we have to look at, and to be concise, really to learn from them, to tailor much better the programs and responses in these countries and settings that are going to be facing, sadly, more and more challenges. So that would be the answer for those questions.
Okay, so Alan, in a world which is ever more diverse and in which large numbers of high-profile politicians and even world leaders are themselves members of diaspora communities, is there a point where membership of a diaspora community ceases to be something that should really be a subject for efforts at engagement? I mean, my obvious example here is our own Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Now, Rishi Sunak is of East African Indian descent. So is it appropriate for people to be looking at Rishi Sunak and thinking, you know, you're a member of our diaspora and therefore we should be activating your membership of that diaspora? Or should he be representing something fundamentally different as Prime Minister of Britain? Specifically, I suppose my key question is this basically something that should always be fundamental in the way that we deal with people, or is it something that should become irrelevant?
It's a great question, Rob. I think the key words in your question are should and appropriate. And then the question really becomes, well, should from whose perspective? From whose perspective is it the right thing to do? So one of the most interesting and controversial things about this type of politics or policy is that, first of all, they've proliferated rapidly in the last few decades. So that's sort of surprising. But theoretically, they're also in violation of some of the key norms of the international system, or what we typically understand of as norms of the international system. So, you know, people make complaints that perhaps, you know, when, say, the Turkish Prime Minister goes to a European country and says something like, integration is a crime against humanity, that is somehow Turkey interfering in the domestic affairs of those European countries. And there are similar examples of those kinds of fears in many other countries as well. There are also concerns about how these types of policies give voice to people who don't have to bear the consequences of the decisions that they're involved in making. And this is particularly a debate when it comes to external voting, but it has wider relevance to the issue of whether a government should be spending its time and energy and resources on empowering and giving voice to people who live abroad and who, you know, won't be around to live under the laws that they help to make. There's also the question of, you know, throughout the whole modern period, particularly in the West, we've seen freedom of exit as a defining feature of liberal democracy. So when people leave a country, we've assumed in liberal democracies that they're kind of off limits because they might be leaving in order to vote with their feet, to express dissent. And so there's sometimes questions raised when countries like, Russia goes out and poisons dissidents in London, or when, you know, Saudi Arabia doesn't like it, when journalists in the US are saying bad things about Saudi Arabia and they engage those journalists by chopping them up and dissolving them in the consulate. And, you know, increasingly authoritarian regimes like China, Myanmar, and others sort of use extraterritorial surveillance and coercion to force people to do things abroad. So, for example, dissidents who are living abroad, they'll say, you know, well, your family's at home, so if you don't say or do the things we want, even though you're living in Singapore or wherever it might be, Australia, we've got your family here, so, you know, if you say the wrong thing, we'll get to them. So there are a lot of legitimate concerns about these types of policies, how they might represent a violation of what it means to be a modern nation state. But if you think back to, I mean, these questions of should and appropriate, well, at one end of the spectrum, we might say that, you know, all group identities are really, in a sense, political projects that are mobilised by particular people in order to increase their power, whether that's simply protection through safety in numbers or whether it's to gain power over others. And so therefore, you know, if you can get people to join your cause and sign up, wear the diaspora t-shirt, wave the diaspora flag, send their money home, then, you know, more power to you. go ahead and do that. That's all any political project ever is. that would be one sort of end of the political spectrum. And then at the other end, you know, from another perspective, we'd be saying it's a question of how strongly are we committed to the principles of the modern international system, and particularly the sort of liberal international world order that's been in place, particularly since World War II. Clearly, some of those principles exist for very good reasons, but some of them might be kind of outdated. Like the idea of one territory, one power, which has been in place since the Treaties of Westphalia at the beginning of the modern period, you know, hundreds of years ago, don't really make a lot of sense in the age of the internet, when, you know, a lot of geopolitical contestation is taking place not in real space and real territory, but in cyberspace. So it might be the case that, you know, we're committed to some principles of the modern international system. We need to be careful about some aspects of diaspora engagement and the extraterritorial interference that it might involve, but that other aspects of it are really to be welcomed, and that the modern international system needs some updating in order to account for the fact that people around the world are just much more connected than they ever were before.
That's a fascinating answer, Alan. Thanks. So Martin, let me, I suppose, wrap up with a question for you, which is, what should the end point or endpoints of diaspora engagement be, if such a thing is possible?
It's a loaded question to end on, Robert.
It's a little bit. Yeah.
Look, I think Alan and Larissa have kind of signaled points of it. Look, I think to unpack a couple of Alan's key points, look, I think the entry point is critical in terms of deciding where the end game is going to be. And I think, you know, look, sometimes we forget to take a little bit of a pause button and look at the world around us sometimes. You know, and I think we're going through a pace, we're living in a world of an incredible pace of change. And you see that not just in industry and different landscapes, but you see it geopolitically. You just have to look at the news of the last couple of weeks to get a handle on this. And I think what really captured me about this episode of the podcast is the word powerful in the title. And sometimes we're a bit naive to not think about the power of diaspora communities. And I think that's what's really capturing the attention of a lot of governments. So look, connotations of power have long evolved from hard power to soft power to smart power, you know, and you mentioned the word connectedness, Alan, I think towards the end of your previous answer, you know, and Professor Anne-Marie Slaughter, when she was beginning to think through power in the networked age, you know, her great line is essentially, to paraphrase, is that the measure of power is connectedness in the networked age. And when you begin to look at what the diaspora communities can bring in terms of connectedness, there's probably very few other global constituencies out there that have the reach. And that's because the numbers don't lie. I mean, going back to the mundane but important issue of definition and immigrants and their descendants, you know, we talk, I think in 1990, there was 150 million migrants in the world. Today, that's 282. You put in the word descendants on top of that growth, and you're talking about a pretty powerful size of community globally, you know. And I think what's important as well in terms of what the end game should be, coming back to Larissa's points, is, you know, it's really important to understand what you're trying to achieve within your diaspora engagement. You know, the diaspora that might engage for humanitarian level to the networks of affluence and influence that Alan talked about, they're fundamentally different diasporas, and they need different approaches, and they need different skills and techniques to engage with them. So, I mean, look, there's been some flagship successes. I mean, to kind of give you some, I suppose, key in the field insights that have been guiding this, we talk a lot about diaspora capital in terms of cultural capital, economic capital, human capital, and social capital. Primarily, I think it's economic capital, as Alan mentioned, for a lot of country of origin governments. You know, you look at projects like the USAID project in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is Diaspora Invests. We're now getting to the stage where we have the evidence to back up what we're talking about. So that was the first phase of that project, for example, was a $6 million commitment by USAID, generated $28 million investment, created 2,000 jobs in about 140 municipalities across the country in the region. So we have the evidence base now. So what it should do and where it should go, one thing I would say, particularly for entry point, is country of origin government. I'm a big believer in the old adage of life, the more that you give, the more you get. You know, so what diaspora engagement policy should do to begin with is to give to their diaspora communities abroad. I think a lot of governments have that blind spot. They look at the potential return because of the big numbers, remittances, everything that attracts us. But I think you have to look at that sense of, you know, to take and adapt that great JFK quote, "Ask not what your diaspora can do for you, but what you can do for your diaspora." Begin there. So it's that balance between giving to the diaspora before expecting to get. But then it's about being incredibly intentional about, are you engaging for humanitarian purposes? Are you engaging for economic development, philanthropic purposes, skills transfer? And to give you a kind of a tagline to close, I say diasporas have time, talent, and treasure. They all need different approaches. And that's where I think most policies probably do go, try to go, but whether they achieve impact or not is open to debate.
Well, I think that time, talent, and treasure seems like a perfect place to wrap up. Alan, Larissa, and Martin, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been a fascinating conversation. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Larissa and Martin.
Thanks, folks.
You've been listening to the Migration Oxford podcast. I'm Rob McNeil.
And I'm Jackie Broadhead.